Accession number 29752, reel number 2.
The farmer, where we had left our bicycles, he comes out and he found us where we were hiding underneath these bushes and near these trees, and he let us know that the plane had not been flown, so they didn't have to service it, so they wouldn't, the plane would not be going by where we were, and there was no reason for them to have the plane running. So that was the end of that little effort. We went back to the farm. We spent the night. The next day, we went on our bicycles back to Madame Vion's. And we're back to life as usual. And a few more days go by. This young lady came on the following, I guess it was the night before the first of the year. And I was rather surprised when she said she was spending the night. Supposedly she was going to sleep downstairs, but she slipped upstairs, and she had made my bed down and put warm bricks in my bed to warm it, and I had already gone to bed, and the lights were out, and Madame Vion had long since gone to bed, and she came up and slipped in bed with me, and we had an adventurous night. The next day was New Year's, and since I knew again that I was leaving, I had some French money that was in my escape kit. I gave some of it to Lily, and I told her to buy something for Madame Vion as a going away present. And she came back with some little statuette, which Madame Vion put on her buffet. It was a statue of Apollo, and I had no idea what she was going to get. I told her just buy something that she knew Madame Vion would like. Well, I don't know whether she liked it or not, but she did put it on display. We celebrated New Year's, and a couple of days after New Year's, she gave me my new identification. She had taken one of the pictures that was in my escape kit and affixed it to this forged identification. And she coached me on how to handle myself on the train and to sit in the classification, but it was a part of the train where people would travel with livestock and chickens, and it was quite an assortment of people, but for the most part, working people and people who had to pay the lowest fare. And when I got on, shortly after I got on, before we had left the train station for Paris, a lady sat next to me, and she said something to me, and I just nodded. I didn't say anything. And somehow or another, she figured out that I was not French. With my beret and all of my beat-up clothes that I had traded for my A2 jacket, she saw through it and obviously figured out that I was an American. And she told me, she says, if they come and ask for identification, or if there's any conversation, she says, you sit still and I'll do the talking. And sure enough, we hadn't left the station very long when the conductor came through with either Gestapo or somebody from the army, I don't know. But they also had on a uniform. And they asked for identification, and she said that she was seeing me to Paris, and that I was handicapped, that I couldn't talk very well, and I couldn't hear very well. And she passed me off as a dummy. And I guess it worked, because they didn't arrest us or anything. When we got to Paris, we got off at one of the stops toward the outside of Paris. It wasn't right downtown. And we, when I say we, the lady, of course, stayed on the train. And I got off because I knew what station that I was supposed to get off. And I met two French ladies. One was a very small lady, and the other was a lady of average height and an attractive lady. The little tiny one was a more elderly person. They took me to her apartment. And at her apartment, they showed me their wonderful plumbing, where you had to stand on a couple of treadles to do whatever you had to do. And we had something to eat there, and we talked for a little bit, and then I went with the younger lady to her home. And we had to get back on the metro to go to her house. She lived on the fifth floor in an apartment, and it was right down near the Eiffel Tower. And we got off, and we had a fairly short walk, and she took me up to her apartment. And she lived with her husband, an infant baby, and her grandparents. And it was a rather crowded affair, but they gave me a room that had been secreted behind a doorway which had been walled in with a bookcase. And at the lower part of the bookcase, there were a couple of doors. Now, that was down at knee level. So to get into the room, you had to get down on your hands and knees to crawl in the doors under the bookcase. And she let me know that whenever anybody knocked on the door, that I should go back to my room and close myself in. This went on for a while. And these were lovely people. And again, they were taking a terrible chance having me in their home, and I knew it. And apparently, not only she, but all of these other people who had helped me, Madame Vion, all of them had helped other Americans, whether they be airmen or whatever they were. Some were British, some were American. And they did this knowing that this could be a terrible sacrifice. While I stayed with these people in Paris, their name was Lamé. While I stayed with them, we went to a couple of football games, and they took me out walking with their baby. And I was very concerned that somebody would turn me in for the reward that was offered for any Allied airman. And I made this known to my friends, the Lamés, and they said, "Don't worry, we wouldn't introduce you to anybody that would cause a problem." Well, somewhere along the line, I guess maybe they didn't know one of their friends, because the day I was supposed to leave to go with a guide to the Pyrenees, the Gestapo walked in, about six strong, all armed with either pistols or submachine guns, and I was captured. They marched me down the stairs, and they took the grandmother with them. And when I got down the stairs, there was a big black Mercedes, and inside there were four women. One of them was the little tiny lady that I had met at the subway station, and the rest of them I didn't know. One of them was a very attractive middle-aged lady. I'd say she was probably in her middle 40s, and she spoke wonderful English, and she let me know that her husband was a professor, and that he was on sabbatical, and he was teaching at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, which is, of course, my home state. We didn't have a chance to do much talking. This I found out later. While we were in the car, we weren't able to say anything. We drove to a downtown building which had been taken over by the Gestapo, and I'm quite sure it was the Gestapo headquarters. We drove into a closed courtyard where we parked, and the building that was facing us in the courtyard had porches on a veranda, I guess you'd call it, on two layers. And as we walked up, they were interrogating people who were standing nude in tubs of water, and they were pouring ice water over them as they interrogated them. And I thought to myself, my God, is this what I've got to go through? And I don't know whether that was just for the benefit of loosening our tongues or what, but it was a pitiful sight to behold. They took us inside, and all of us were put in one room, which was a cell that had just a peephole. The cell itself was a rectangular cell that you were out of sight of the peephole if you went down to one end. Now, being locked up with five women, let's see, there was, I guess there were five women altogether. And being locked up with them was really quite an ordeal. There was one chamber pot in the cell, and absolutely no privacy. There was one cot. Well, the lady from Charlottesville very quickly let me know that this might be the last day that we're going to be around, and that this would be our last chance to have sex. And she didn't beat around the bush. She said she would like to be loved before she goes to her death. And the other women, the little lady that I met in the at the subway, she was eating up pictures and all kind of identification that was in her handbag. And all the other women were looking through their handbags for any telltale information that they might want to conceal. And I tried to resist this business of making love in front of these other women. But she says, look, she says, they'll turn their heads. They'll turn their heads to the wall. So sure enough, we used the cot, and one of the other women was warming up to the idea when they started taking us out for interrogation. The interrogations lasted the better part of that day, and they would take us one at a time. And late at night, it seemed like we couldn't see outside because it was an entirely closed-off room, and the only thing was one electric light in the room. So they had taken my watch from me, and none of us knew really what time it was, but it seemed like it had been a long time. It had probably been about 12 hours from the time that we were originally locked up. When they came and marched us all out, and they put us into this bus, which was made into cells, separate little cells, so each one of us was put in a separate little cell with a small little aisle down the center of the bus or truck. And my first thought was that they were going to gas us and dump us somewhere. But we drove quite some while, and we ended up at a prison which they pronounce Friend. It was outside of the downtown area of Paris, but it was an old prison, probably dated back some time, judging by some of the inscriptions and writings on the walls of the cells. But here we were separated, and I was put into solitary confinement in a basement with nothing more than a pile of straw on the floor. And it was pitch dark when I was put in the cell, so I didn't really know what was in the cell. The only glimpse that I got of the cell was when they opened the door to put me in it. And I quickly discovered that I had visitors in the cell in the way of bugs and things that were crawling around in that straw. But I couldn't resist it. I couldn't stand up all night, so I finally laid down and I had a rather fitful sleep. When I woke up in the morning, filtered in from the louvers from above, and I could see the rest of my cell now. In the corner, there was a faucet, a cold water faucet. It had an icicle hanging from it about a foot long. And then there was a place that you could relieve yourself, and the big pile of straw on the floor.
There was no bunk, and I woke up still scratching and found that I had several bites on me. At an early hour, I could hear a cart rattling down the long corridor. Finally, I could hear doors opening and closing to other cells, and it stopped in front of my cell, and the door opened. A soldier who was accompanying the person pushing the cart hollered attention. I stood up, and they brought in a bowl of something and gave it to me and hollered at ease, or the equivalent of at ease, I don't recall the term that they used, and they were gone. It was still early in the morning, and you could see it was the new light of day from the filtered light coming in. And the bowl that they gave me was filled with what smelled like something like coffee, and I found out that it was ersatz coffee. I tasted it. It was horrible tasting stuff, but the bowl was nice and warm, so I kind of hugged that bowl and held it in my hands just for the warmth that I got from it. But after it had gone cold, I just dumped it down the sewer for the where they had the toilet. The day went without any interruptions. Nothing happened all day long. Late in the afternoon, another cart stopped in front of my door. This time, there was a bowl of soup and a piece of bread. The soup was watery. There was very little in it in the way of sustenance. But it was welcomed because I was now hungry. My leg was beginning to bother me, and I could see that I was getting some infection. I didn't know exactly what to do. When they came and delivered my food, I asked, could I see a medic or a doctor? They grunted and left. It was soon night, and again I was confined to that bed. I don't want to drag this on. This went on for some time. After some period of time, during which I did get a bath, I did not ever see a medic. My leg was infected. I cleaned it the best I could from the cold tap water. They did take us out for exercise for 1 hour, where you were marched around a walled area. And I got to see other people, and they were obviously, we couldn't talk or anything, but there were obviously a number of American prisoners there. After a period of a week or so, they started to interrogate me. The interrogations were fairly routine at first, conducted by Army personnel, and they went quickly, and the answers and questions were rather routine. I had now been down for some time, so I guess anything that I knew probably would be of little help to them. But after several interrogations, which started out friendly enough, where they would offer you a cigarette and all, they began to get a little mean, and the interrogator was obviously a Gestapo. And when he didn't like the answers to my questions, he would kick me in my sore leg. I guess you might call this a form of torture. I really wasn't hurt all that badly, but when he kicked me, of course, it was very painful. Again, I asked to see a medic, and on the following day, I did get to see someone who gave me some pills for that would supposedly arrest the infection. And they gave me a clean bandage, but it really wasn't a bandage. It was a paper bandage. I guess they had a shortage of bandages. And After several more such interrogations, they brought in a dossier on me that really knew all about me. They had wonderful intelligence. A lot of this, I'm sure, was gleaned from newspapers, but everything from where I trained in the States, when I got my commission, when I went overseas, when I landed in Scotland, how many victories I had. They told me about several of the boys that had been lost that I didn't know about, that had gone down. They really knew a lot about my group and about my squadron. I tried to reveal as little as I could about what I knew of the people that helped me. They seemed to know quite a bit, but they didn't know it all, and I didn't really reveal any more than they had. After that, they put me in a cell with some other Americans, two Americans and one British, a British airman. He was a gunner on a Lancaster. And it was good to have company. And now, instead of sleeping on the floor, we had cots that folded down from the wall and a stuffed straw mattress, which was a little bit better than what I was used to in the basement. One day, shortly after being in a cell with others, and incidentally the food had improved somewhat and it was a little bit more plentiful, but still it was a starvation diet, they transferred us by train. The Gestapo and army were in charge, and after traveling for some time, we ended up in Frankfurt, Main, in Germany. And here I was imprisoned in it was a Gestapo prison. And here they kind of put the fear of God into us by parading some prisoners that looked like nothing but bones and skeletons. They were so thin and so emaciated that it was unbelievable that they could even walk. I don't know whether this was something that they caused or something that they paraded by just to intimidate us. Here again, I was in solitary confinement, but the living conditions were clean, the cells were clean, the bunks were clean, and they tried to get us to do some work in that they had us gluing up little envelopes for medicines. And since I was determined not to do any work, I would glue them all together. I got by with this for a few days. Then I guess they decided where these envelopes were coming from. They came to my cell and let me know that if I didn't start making these things and not gluing them together and doing them the way they wanted them to be done, that I would not get any rations at all, except water. I put up with the water for a couple of days, and I decided eating was more important. So I started making envelopes the way they wanted them. Again, we went through interrogations, and these people meant business, and they let you know about it. They slapped you around a little bit. And I was here for perhaps 3 or 4 days when a night raid, a British night raid, really caught the whole city on fire. There was also a hit that was direct on part of this prison, and the plaster and ceiling came tumbling down. I stood in the archway of the protected doorway, which was a construction wall, where the door to the cell was, and watched the place disintegrate around me. I could hear a lot of running around, and there were sirens, and you could hear fire equipment, but all I could see was the red sky again through the louvers that were above me, situated much the way they were in the Friend prison. And they rounded up a lot of political prisoners and brought them down into the basement. But so far as I was concerned, I was left in my cell, and I'm sure others were too, that they didn't consider important. After further interrogation here, which it must have gone on for a period of maybe 2 weeks, we were transported by bus outside of Frankfurt to a holding site run by the Luftwaffe for further interrogation. And it was called, I don't recall what they call it. It was not a Stalag, but a Dulag, where you were interrogated and they decided what camp you were going to go to. And from there we went to various sites. I went to Barth, where Stalag Luft 1 was located. The interrogation here was fairly routine. My information now was past being important, and they knew everything about my plane, which when I went down was a new plane and they didn't have any in their possession. But now I've found that they did have some P-47s intact in their possession, so there was little or nothing that I could tell them. I think I learned more from them than they learned from me. They told me more of the history of my group and about other people who had gone down and who had been captured. In Stalag Luft 1, you are familiar, I'm sure, with what happened there. Zemke's book, which you wrote, was quite informative. You even told me things that I didn't know. I had had a reunion, a group reunion, which I attended. It was the last one that I saw Zemke before he died, which was a couple of years ago. And at that particular reunion, they honored Hub and named a couple of streets after him at a base there in Tampa, Florida. And on one evening, I was out with the boys from my squadron, and Zemke was in attendance. And Zemke sat at a table with me and my wife and another one of my classmates. It was just the four of us. And then there was a long table where most everybody else was seated. And I had a most interesting evening, and he told me of many of the things that you wrote about in your book that I found out for the first time. He also told me of his participation in getting planes that he bought back from Spain to get to Korea. Zemke was one of my heroes, and I knew Zemke from the time he was just been promoted to captain until he became my CO in Stalag Luft 1. There were many others that joined me there. So far as life in the camp was concerned, you have heard it all. So far as my own personal story was concerned, when we were liberated by the Russians, Hub had told everyone not to leave the camp. But I did leave the camp with a boy by the name of Mike Quirk, another member of my former squadron, and a boy by the name of Cal Reeder. And the three of us took a rowboat across the inlet. When we went to go, there were some Russian troops that had come over, and they were swimming. And I was quite surprised to find that some of those swimming, when they took their clothes off, were female soldiers. Now, whether they were actually soldiers or whether they merely accompanied the Russian troops for the convenience of having females, I don't know that. But there were a lot of boys that paired up with them because it had been a long time since we'd been with women. Anyhow, Mike and Cal and myself went across the inlet, and we caught a ride on a farm wagon manned by some Russian soldiers, one of whom was merely a child of maybe 12 years old. And, of course, they were all armed to the teeth. And everything that they carried to drink in their canteen seemed to consist of vodka. And so they were kind of high. And on the way into this little town, the kid, to show off that he was a real soldier, he shoots a couple of cows out in the field for no good reason at all and just left them there. They weren't shot to eat them or for any valid reason. We soon found that the best way to get along with the Russians was just to go along with them and smile and laugh and not try to condemn them or teach them any manners. They had a custom of exchanging things. If they saw something on you they liked, such as a wristwatch or anything that you might have that they wanted, you'd merely swap with them, and they in turn would either offer you a drink of vodka or maybe something that they had. So some of the boys picked up a few souvenirs. We found that this town that they had occupied was in a terrible state of turmoil, and they had rounded up most of the women in the camp, most of the women in the town, and brought them to this one hotel that was downtown. And I'm afraid that a lot of raping and torture went on in that hotel. We went toward the outskirts of town to spend the night. We knocked on a door. Some farmers, and there was an old man that lived there with his son and his wife and their two daughters, and they begged us to spend the night with them, and they put a sign on the door saying Americans are staying here so that the Russians wouldn't bother them.